Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Luli, how nice to see you. You must be coming to the end of your sabbatical. Have you changed your view of cocktail culture as a result?
Partly, Felicity, yes. But I have also learned that I really like mezcalita.
What is that? I assume it's got mezcal in it, but you have to explain further.
Yeah, it's kind of like a mezcal margarita sort of with attitude. So it's usually finished on, you know, on the rim with tagine. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing things wrong. But anyway, it's the chili lime salt mix that goes around the rim, and it basically turns one sip into a full sensory event.
So you've become a mezcal lover since you've been in Mexico.
Yes, I have. So I'm going to, can I do a really quick shout out promo?
I think you must.
Okay. So when I was in Mexico City, I went to an agave tasting run by the amazing Sophia at the Salon de Agave. So it was an incredible kind of two and a half hour tutor tasting, learning everything about agave varieties, growing, production, regions, flavors. It was truly fascinating and really interesting, actually, because there are a lot of parallels to wine. So I would highly recommend going to Salon de Agave to anyone that happens to be in Mexico City. Yes, but back to updates. You were at Provine last week, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yes. A couple of weeks ago, yes.
Yes. So previously, the most attended wine trade show in the world. How was it?
Very different from previous years. So it was quieter, it was smaller, a lot less energy in the past. And you know where I really noticed it is usually you can charge around trade fairs. You can walk quite fast, but I couldn't this one because so many people were loitering in the aisles just sort of chatting about stuff. With one thing, the non-alcohol was really big, which I thought was a bit weird.
Okay, why did you think that was weird?
Because it was much bigger than the lower nose section of Paris. But I think I've been thinking about it since, and I think I know why. Because I think it's the Germans are really innovative when it comes to this category.
Okay, so maybe that's not so surprising, because didn't you tell me that they pretty much kind of invented, Germans that is, invented the no non-alcohol beer category, which is the sort of foundation of the whole no-alc category?
You've got a very good memory, despite all the mezcal. Yes, the other notable success that Germany had apart from the non-alc beer was a wine called the Leitz 150 Riesling, which was launched in 2015, and that was one of the first non-alcoholic wines to sort of come into mainstream success.
So as if we planned this, Felicity, that leads us rather nicely into this
question. Of course we didn't. There was no planning involved whatsoever.
Yes. So this week's question is, it's all about no alcohol drinks. So what's the evolution? What's worked and why? What does the future hold in terms of no alcohol products? And what are we going to see?
What a good question, Luli. Where'd you get that from? Because while we have talked about who drinks low and no alcohol, we haven't really discussed the evolution of the drinks themselves. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So shall we go back to beer to kick off? Because we were just talking about beer.
Yeah, and the beer's getting very good, very fast.
Yeah, so do you remember when I did the super research for our Guinness episode when I went to the Guinness Storehouse in Dublin, and I was commenting then about the fact that it's actually really difficult, well, it was difficult for me to tell the difference between Guinness Zero and regular Guinness.
Yeah, and you know, since you told me that, I've heard a lot of people say very similar things, and somebody even told me that Guinness Zero is now a staple of Irish weddings because it means people can drive home instead of having to book an overnight hotel.
Yeah, well, that's very reasonable, very sensible, isn't it? And really obvious, but I guess it makes me think just a few years ago, if you went into a pub, particularly I'm imagining in Ireland, and ordered, oh, can I have a non-alcoholic beer, please? You were sort of inviting comments about, you know, have you got a health condition or what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I think this is one of the really positive changes. So I remember being in an Australian pub about 30 years ago, and there was a man who asked for Coke or something like that. And the publican mocked him publicly and asked if he wanted a glass of milk as well. It was terrible. So in one sense, we've witnessed an extraordinary social change. But in another sense, Lily, this has all happened before.
Okay. So podcast historian, why don't you give us the historic parallels then that we can unpack where and we can kind of look at this to see whether they can help us predict what might happen next with non-alcoholic.
Well, thank you for opening the door, Lily. I'd love to talk about it. Okay, good. So just let me run through the let me run through the rise of non-alcohol drinks the first time around, because what happened to them has some implications, I think, for non-alcoholic drinks today. Okay, so the most important thing is that for most of the history of alcohol consumption, beer and wine were much lower in strength than what we drink today. So beer was typically around 2% alcohol by volume. And what that meant was people could drink it all day.
Because and part of the reason they were doing that was because water was contaminated, so it kind of had a genuine purpose.
Yes, I mean, I've spoken to an anthropologist about this. He said people wouldn't have been aware of the, you know, the effect in that sense, but they would have just known that when they drank beer, they had a healthier outcome. But so you can see this pattern right across Europe, and you get wine being diluted in countries like France and Italy as well.
When you say diluted there, do you literally mean diluted with water? Because wasn't the point we were just talking about that beer, unlike water, wasn't contaminated?
Yeah, I do mean diluted with water. And don't forget, wine regions obviously had a tendency towards wine as their drink of choice, and it was also a traded good. But here's the thing, a lot of wine was really rough to drink. It was horrible, or it was very acidic. So adding water actually made the stuff drinkable. It also meant that you could drink pretty much throughout the day without getting drunk.
So that's how people managed to drink so much of it in terms of volume, I guess.
That's right. So until you get the emergence of distilled spirits, which is a lot later, which are absolutely much higher in alcohol, you don't really have this social distinction between you're drinking or you're not drinking, which is what we have now.
As ever, Felicity, I've learned something from you that I didn't know. So basically what you're saying is that because drinking such low alcohol, low ABVs, doesn't have the same consequences as higher strength options, so the line between drinking and not drinking alcohol were really blurred then at this time.
Yeah, that's right. So to be clear, people also drank for pleasure, and there are lots of church writings warning against drunkenness, which must mean there was plenty of it around, or they wouldn't have wasted paper on it. But the distinction we have today between sobriety and drinking wasn't such a thing.
No. Okay. Felicity, can I do a quick tangent?
I love your tangents, Lily. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. So a really, really quick one. What we were saying there about the blurred line between drinking and non-drinking, she said she went to the doctor when she found out that she was pregnant, and she was ashamed to admit that she smoked about 5 cigarettes a day and had done so when she was early stage pregnancy without knowing she was pregnant. And guess what? The French doctor told her that smoking 5 a day is too low to be counted as a smoker.
So that reminds me, I had a girlfriend here in Germany. This is about 14, 15 years ago. She was pregnant and she was overdue, and her doctor recommended she go home and drink beer to get the process going. So it's a very different world.
It is. Anyway, so back on track. So you're saying spirits, back to spirits. You were saying that they changed
everything. So distillation as a process had been known since the medieval world, but you start to see the commercial distillation of spirits for drinking in the 17th century, and that changed everything. So, of course, spirits are very high strength, and it led to a lot of social disorder of a type the authorities had never seen before. So suddenly alcohol became a massive social problem. And then actually the other thing that happened is it became equated with leisure because it became a branded good.
Okay, so we talked about this before, haven't we, in our episode on gin and tonic, which led to sort of rather a lot of debauchery, particularly in parts of London and elsewhere,
This was the period of huge scientific advances, right? This is the Enlightenment, which had a major impact on people's beverage patterns generally, which has something to do with the rise of non-alc. So in the 18th century, the chemist Joseph Priestley started experimenting with gas, and he's the guy who discovered oxygen. But more importantly for this story, he suspended a bowl of water above a beer vat at a brewery in Leeds and discovered that process could infuse the water with carbon dioxide.
So the first thing I'm thinking when you say that is what made him, what prompted him to put a bowl over brewery anyway.
He just had an inquiring mind, apparently.
Apparently.
And he obviously knew somebody who had a brewery.
Yes. So the mind boggles, but more seriously, thereby inventing sparkling water.
That's right. Except in his writings, he called it, get this, impregnated water.
Okay. So speaking as the marketeer on the podcast here, I would have advised him against naming that in that inferred positioning. But considering we all drink sparkling water today, I guess it didn't matter.
No, well, Europeans already had this idea that sparkling water was good for you because they saw it as taking the waters, like immersing themselves in it. So they used to trek off to places like Vichy and Bath where the water bubbled. So one of my favourite of these places is a place called Baden-Baden in Germany, which literally means bath.
Have you been there?
I have. I went once and I will never go again.
Okay, why?
So you're not allowed into Friedrichsbad, the big famous bath, unless you take everything off. And my girlfriend and I discovered that the day we went and took our clothes off, it was the mixed sexes day. And I haven't recovered. That was a long time ago.
Oh, my goodness. Do you know what? It reminds me of similar memories of saunas and Austrian skiing. Holidays, which is not so great for us English prudes.
Well, here's the thing. Before I went into Friedrichsbad, I thought I knew everything about human anatomy, and it turns out I didn't.
Let's move on. Move on. I have images in my head now, Felicity. Let's get us back on track, please. So let's remove those images. So you're saying that people adopted drinking sparkling water because they associated it with health benefits. Yes.
That's right. And because, like I said, this is a scientific revolution, there were other things happening at the same time. So this is also the period when chemists began to understand plant compounds better than they had done. Things like alkaloids, stimulants and bitters.
Yeah, and of course, I'm guessing at this time, maybe you can confirm that there was sort of no regulation.
Yeah. I confirm.
Yes, you confirm. Yeah, so you could basically put plant compounds and sparkling water together and kind of get these health tonics, or at least claim they're health tonics.
That's right. And so there was a huge proliferation of them. Now, this is the emergence of what we now think of as soft drinks, which are genuine adult alternatives to alcohol. So the most famous one that people probably know today is Coca-Cola, which was launched in 1886 by John Pemberton. So that's the one I think is the most obvious one.
Yeah, and it's the main point here is that it's using cocoa leaf, which is a basis for cocaine.
We wish it still did. But anyway, it was sold as a brain tonic and a nerve stimulant, so it was a true adult drink. And the year before, I should mention, was the creation of Dr. Pepper, who was also it was also being sold as a tonic. So this is the rise of what we now think of as soft drinks.
Yeah, but these weren't for children. These were very much adult beverages.
That's right, and they were actually sold in drugstores or what we in Europe would call pharmacies.
Yeah.
And so this established the so-called soda fountain as an alternative drinking space.
So when you say soda fountain, it always reminds me of those Norman Rockwell paintings, you know, from the 1950s of kind of kids in these places.
That's right. And this was part of their appeal in the US. So saloons in late 19th century America were overwhelmingly male and associated with gambling and prostitution.
Oops.
And all of the social ills that come along with drinking a lot of hard liquor. Whereas the soda fountains were mixed gender and even kids could go there.
Yeah. Yeah, so when they're basically providing sociability, so without the social risk that comes with alcohol that you were just talking about.
That's right. And this really matters because it's not long before the temperance people start noticing. So temperance had been on the rise since the early 19th century, since about the 1820s, which was largely a response to the havoc being caused by distilled spirits.
Yeah.
And by the late 19th century, it was a real social force. So you've got the Women's Christian Temperance Union of 1874, the Anti-Saloon League of 1893. But you also see this in Britain. You see temperance bars, which are explicitly alcohol-free social spaces spreading through working class towns, particularly in the north. So you have the rise of these alternatives to alcohol as well as a growing number of places to actually drink them.
Yeah, so it's a parallel drinking culture that's also sort of adult and sophisticated. So I guess this is the bit that kind of gets lost in the history, doesn't it? Because we think of temperance as being sort of prohibition rather than a compelling category or safer space in its own right.
That's right. So you have alcohol and non-alcohol existing in sort of different spaces. But then, unfortunately, you get the Big Bang. You get the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution ratified in 1919. Yeah. The Volstead Act took effect in January 1920 and suddenly America has prohibition.
Okay. Fun fact, Felicity, while we're on prohibition, just mentioned it. So I learned in my Salander Agave class that northern Mexico basically had its own version of it. So in Sonora, in the state in north, agave spirits were banned from 1915.
America dominates everything. So we think that prohibition is American, but actually there was prohibition in a lot of places.
Yeah.
So with the agave, was it fully illegal?
Yeah, fully. So production, sale, everything. Which basically meant that the local agave spirit, Bancanora, went underground for, get this, 75 years. So we had proper kind of moonshine territory going on.
Yeah, and I bet that moonshine was actually more dangerous than the stuff that was being sold commercially.
Yeah, but it gets better. It only became legal again in 1992.
1992?
Yeah.
That's really recent.
I know. And then, because regulation loves a glow-up, by 2000, it had its own DOC. It's had its own denomination.
Wow. So it went from illegal to being protected in just about a decade. So I guess what that tells us is somebody worked out it was a great way to earn tax revenue.
Exactly. So from bootleg to apelación, which is why today it's not called mezcal. It's Bacanora, which is, same agave roots, but a completely different legally defined category. There you go.
Okay. So going back to prohibition and temperance movements, you'd think that this would be the moment that non-alcoholic drinks would shine.
Yes.
But unfortunately, as luck would have it, you get another technological invention at the same time. You get ice cream.
For once I know where you're going with this. Industrial refrigeration made ice cream cheaper and more accessible, which means more ice cream sundaes for all of us, which means the soda fountains become less about bitter drinks and more about dessert.
Exactly. And so what happens is that these spaces completely lose their adult character.
So it's how kind of Coke becomes a drink for kids.
That's right. And then so prohibition ends in 1933 and alcohol roars back as the marker of adult social life. But non-alcoholic drinks kind of got stuck in adolescence where prohibition left them. So they remained with families and in the domestic daytime space.
Yeah, and now we're seeing the rise of functional drinks again, which I guess are the sort of modern equivalent of the cocoa infused or the tonics that you were talking about, the sparkling water tonics. But where does genuine non-alcohol, as in the non-alcohol versions of alcohol drinks, really start?
Okay, so this is where the beer comes in. It really starts with beer.
Okay, so this is where you were saying earlier, its roots are in Germany.
No. Oh. Funnily enough, it was actually American brewers who were trying to make something they could sell during Prohibition. So the Volstead Act defined intoxicating liquor as anything above 0.5% alcohol by volume. So companies like Anheuser-Busch developed products called Bevo, which was known as a near beer.
Okay, so let me guess. They would have had to have stopped the fermentation early, but then that would have tasted really sweet. Or they tried to get rid of the alcohol by heating, which effectively cooks the liquid.
Yeah, now I don't know if it's called Bevo or Bevo, but whatever it was called, it was disgusting apparently. The results were so bad that it stigmatized the category for decades.
So the stigma problem must have been true in Germany too, I imagine, especially when they take beer so seriously. It's such a large part of the market.
So oddly enough, no. So first of all, America was a long way away, so they didn't know what was going on in America. But secondly, America, even in the early 20th century, was completely dominated by big beer companies and they were all busy producing this terrible stuff.
Okay.
Germany, on the hand, had lots of little beer companies that were all looking for a competitive advantage and they were all, busy doing their own research and experimentation. So in the late 1960s, West Germany brought in very strict drink driving legislation. So people were actively looking for an alternative to drink at lunch that wouldn't land them in jail, basically.
Okay, So in marketing terms, we'd say that was like a kind of demand signal existing first. So that's quite unusual in that it's the regulation that's creating the demand rather than the consumers themselves, potentially.
Yeah, well, I guess it was happening in tandem. But anyway, so there's a company called Klaus Thaler, and it began developing a controlled fermentation process around about about 1973. So instead of getting rid of the alcohol after fermentation mechanically, they redesigned the process to interrupt fermentation. Okay. And so they released their first beer in 1979. And I guess they must have done it in some way that didn't leave the beverage incredibly sweet, which was the problem in the US.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really quite, from a technical point of view, a really sort of big development cycle in this journey.
Yeah. And I gather it was really difficult to do. And so according to their own account, they didn't actually tell anybody it was non-alcoholic because they wanted retailers and bar owners to stock it before they knew what it actually was.
Well, that's really weird. So that's like kind of concealing your core proposition, which in brand management terms is the sort of, you know, a category contamination problem. So the product's perceived value was kind of comes into question before a single bottle is actually opened. So that's quite a tough problem to overcome if you're not positioning it as non-alcohol.
So, of course, we know with 2020 hindsight here in 2026 that it must have worked. And it created the category of non-alcoholic beer, which is now made using multiple approaches. So, you know, beer companies sometimes mechanically remove alcohol, but they have also developed special strains of yeast and so on.
Yeah. And it took decades and a lot of investment then, we're saying, didn't it, to get there from an innovation point of view. But it's really paid off. So Heineken launched 00 in 2017. For example, after years of development, and by the first half of 2024, they were seeing double-digit growth in that in the 00. And then if we go back to Germany, so we were talking about Germany. So Germany itself shows is now a lead indicator that showing the category of no alcohol beer is sort of moving towards mainstream. So about 10% of retail beer sales in Germany and now no alcohol beer.
Yeah, and I can really see it when I go to Lidl. Lidl, the beer section is absolutely packed with non-alcoholic beer. It's quite near the gin and tonic in the can, actually.
Oh, well, then it's handy for you. And I see it, you see it too, if I look at in the UK, the kind of growth of the zero alcohol beer sections in retailers and also in the US, across the US. Talking of the US, in the US, you also, well, it's partly driven by the phenomena that is known as athletic brewing. Didn't you interview the co-founder, Bill? Can't remember his surname.
Schufeld.
Schufeld.
So the full credit for that goes to the Business Drinks podcast with Erica Ducey. We did episode together, which you can still find.
Okay, a great episode. I remember listening to it.
I always say my podcast episodes are great, Luli.
I do. Always supportive, your sideline cheerleader, Felicity, as you well know. So anyway, in the episode, Bill outlines how he and master brewer John Walker, if I'm remembering correctly, founded Athletic Brewing in like only 2017. I can't believe it was actually not that long ago. And it was all about repositioning the category as soon as they launched their first product, wasn't it? So he was talking about, they weren't positioning it as non-alcoholic beer, as a substitute effectively for alcohol, but as a separate performance lifestyle product or category.
Yeah, so they experimented a lot and then they released their first product in 2018.
Okay.
And Bill talked about how he personally sponsored 70 to 75 races across New England and he'd hand out samples to runners at the front line so people would, they'd have a chance to try it. But he said when he did it, people would make fun of the product before they actually tried it.
I remember that. I remember in the episode because you were talking about his response at the time was he was saying that people make fun of me or to make fun of it and then they taste it and then very quickly within about 90 seconds people are saying, oh, where can I get this, because they were loving the taste. So the turnaround was happening really quickly.
Yeah, that's right. And of course it's become one of the biggest success stories in recent beverage history.
Yeah, absolutely. So by 2022, Athletic had become the third best-selling craft beer by dollar value in retail in the US. And they raised a load of money.
They did
like over nearly $175 million in about five rounds, I think it was. So some data. So by 2024, in terms of the total category here, and we're talking about the US and no alcohol beer, IWSR was recording that volumes were up in the US of no alcohol beer around 30% year on year, and Athletic holds somewhere around 20% of the US non-alcoholic beer category. So therefore driving more dollar growth in the category than any other single brand.
Yeah, and I should be clear, because this is always something from business journalism, that it's always nice to present this as the tale of two beer lovers who wanted something they could drink in other circumstances. But Bill Schufelt knew what was going on in the German market, and he was also a hedge fund manager with a lot of analytic ability, so he could see there was a market opportunity just sort of waiting to happen. And I think he also wanted it for himself.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I also found really interesting listening to that episode when you were discussing it is that he actively welcomed the arrival of Heineken 00 and Guinness 00, because basically it's expanding the category and giving the whole category of zero alcohol beer sort of legitimacy. So his point was, if I remember also, that a younger consumer who sees Athletic alongside Guinness 00 finds it much easier to choose a no alcohol beer option as a result.
Yes. And this question of the master branding of Guinness and Heineken becomes really important. But we'll get to that in a second. But so far, beer has absolutely been the big winner in the non-alcoholic category.
Yeah, and it can be genuinely hard to tell, as we were saying, alcoholic and non-alcoholic beer apart now because of the product quality. We were discussing that earlier. But if we move now to wine, that's something else, isn't it? Because the ethanol in wine, talking about tasting of the products, the ethanol in wine does a lot more of the structural work than it does in beer. So it carries the flavours. So removing the alcohol kind of does quite a lot of damage or it really impacts the flavour profile. And you've got a second thing going on here, haven't you? Because if you're trying to go from like 4 or 5% ABV from a beer to zero, you know, that's one thing. But in wine, we're going from 12, 13, 14, 15 ABV down to zero. It's a much bigger gap.
Yeah, that's right. And it's harder to get a genuinely very low or no alcohol product through natural means, through fermentation. Mm. So either you have to stop the fermentation early, which still leaves quite a bit of alcohol in it and also a lot of sugar. It's typically very unbalanced. Or people have tried to introduce sort of special strains of yeast and bacteria to do the fermentation, and that introduces very weird flavours. So really the only thing you can do is to remove it mechanically.
Yeah, or you can take the alcohol out altogether, but then that removes the flavour and the aromas we were just talking about. Yeah. So I've been told by people much cleverer than myself in this area, so winemakers, that it tends to work best with the more aromatic varieties like Riesling or Sauvignon Blanc, where you might have enough of that kind of aroma left to compensate for what we were just talking about.
It does work to some extent with very, very aromatic varieties. But if you try that same sort of alcohol removal process on a delicate wine like a Burgundy, all you're going to have is a very, very unpleasant product that doesn't really resemble wine.
Yeah, which is why non-alcoholic sparkling wine is doing better as a category, but also can taste better. So the carbonation added to de-alkalized wine adds that sort of mouthfeel back to what can be, you know, we were just talking about rather a thin liquid, and the oxygenation from the bubbles amplifies the flavour notes that remain.
Yes, so we're back to our old friend carbonation, which is very important in this story, because this brought about the rise of the soft drink. Actually, you know, I've been told that people are getting picky about carbonation, about big bubbles versus small bubbles. We should probably do an episode on this.
Okay, that's so seriously niche.
Isn't that unbelievable? How luxurious and decadent are we as a society when you start complaining about big bubbles versus small bubbles?
There is something seriously going on wrong there, isn't there? Anyway, let's get back on track again. So if we look at IWSR data again, so the market, we were talking about sparkling non-alcohol wine, and that's definitely leading the no alcohol wine overall. So the sparkling is growing ahead of the non-sparkling wine in no alcohol, but it's still pretty small for listing.
Yeah, I mean, wine is very hard. It's got a problem that's going to be very hard to overcome. Mm. So, however, you do see the big companies putting enormous research efforts into it. So in France, Castelfraire has announced the opening of a 10 million euro vacuum distillation plant that might be able to produce millions of bottles a year. And last year it was the turn of Treasury Wine Estate, who opened a Australian $15 million non-alc facility in the Barossa Valley. So I guess we'll see.
We will see. So fine, if we now move to the third category, spirits, because we looked at beer, we looked at wine. So now we could say the problems are almost sort of insurmountable because you can't, you know, use the equivalent of a spinning cone or reverse osmosis or any of those methods we were talking about to remove alcohol and expect to have something drinkable in spirits.
That's right, because ethanol pretty much is the product, more or less. So if you take out the alcohol, then you say pretty much goodbye to 100% of flavours and aromas.
Yeah, which means, therefore, that the non-alcoholic spirits category has to ask a completely different question to beer and wine that we were just talking about, which is not how do we remove the alcohol, but how do we construct an experience of drinking spirits without using alcohol? So it's kind of ran the other way.
Yes, I think there have been some interesting attempts, but I think the first one that really came to my attention was Seedlip. Is that right, Lily?
Yeah, I believe so. So certainly in terms of sort of global traction. So the story that the founder, Ben Branson, tells basically is that he found this 1651 herbal remedy book on the art of distillation.
It was just there.
On his side table. And he started to experiment with distillation using herbs from his garden, actually his farm, I believe. I think they were farmers. And he then goes on to order a non-alcoholic cocktail in London when he was in a restaurant, and he was disgusted with how sugary it was. So he went back to his still and worked on what eventually became Seedlip.
Yeah, I remember all the hype around it. So it was launched at Selfridges department store in London. And for listeners who don't know that, it's very posh.
Yes.
In about 2015. And I heard, you know, all about the story about how it takes 6 weeks to macerate this and that, distill, filter, blend. And so I ordered a bottle.
You did. And what did you think?
I tried it once and I put it back on the shelf and I never touched it again. I could not see what the fuss was about. And it was also very expensive.
Yeah, okay. I'm not to diss Seedlip or Ben or anything else, but I tried it once as well, Felicity. Never went back. Yeah.
What's happened to your bottle? Is it still on the shelf?
Yeah, I think it might have been cold in one of my drinks cabinet clear out moments because it sat there for a very long time.
This is one of the really big problems with the spirits analogues is that people buy them, and when you buy a spirit, you expect it to last forever. And actually, these analogues don't last forever. They only last for a couple of months because they don't have the alcohol in it as preservation. Anyway, I cut you off.
Yes. No. But we were both kind of saying, not for us. But you know what? Diageo didn't agree with us, Felicity. They took a stake in 2016, which, do you remember, we mentioned that in our last episode, by which time it was, you know, Seedlip was in 25 countries and listed in more than, you know, over 7,000 restaurants, bars and hotels. So its presence really forced other drinks companies to ask whether it was time to sort of add these non-alcohol spirit options, if we can call them spirits.
Yeah, and I guess to be very fair, Ben Branson was starting from scratch. And so not only did he identify a need, but he created a whole category.
Absolutely.
And it's also true, let's be fair, that these types of drinks hardly ever work with themselves, including gin. You know, everything is much improved by adding tonic water.
Many things are improved by adding tonic water. Even some of my homemade cocktails are as well. Yes, but it's the same problem that we've already talked about, isn't it? Which is that alcohol carries so much of the flavour. So the second generation of non-alcohol spirits got increasingly creative, therefore, thinking about how to try and replicate that mouthfeel rather than just the flavours themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I've actually interviewed a few non-alc
founders
on Drinks Insider.
Of course you have.
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting is the Danish brand Ish, founded by Morten Sorensen. Now, I think from memory, he used the hulls of chili seeds to kind of give it a sense of bite.
Yeah, which is really worth dwelling on for a moment, isn't it? Because it shows how rapidly the category has kind of matured outside the obvious markets that you would typically think of. So if I'm correct, it was founded in 2018 after Sorensen had done this sort of 100-day alcohol-free challenge. And Ish describes itself as the only brand in the world to offer a full category range of alcohol-free wine, spirits, cocktails and beer. And its first account, according to them, was at 11 Madison Park in New York, which, as you know, is one of the restaurants that's regularly topped as the best restaurants in the world lists.
Yeah, and this sort of approach of trying to find things that add bitterness or bite is actually really the backbone of this category. So I think there's one called Ritual Zero Proof in America, and they, you know, they do this thing about adding a burn factor into their gin alternative. So they add black peppercorn and rock salt. So they think that it's the absence of a warming sensation, which was one of the things that made the early non-alcoholic spirits pretty unconvincing.
So it sounds a bit like my mezcalita with the rimmed top with chili salt and lime. Yes. There you go. So that's what we're creating. Except it's got mezcal. Mm. Anyway, so the aperitivo end of the market is where this category is doing really some of its best work, partly because aperitivos often are based around bitterness. And that's partly what we were just talking about. So you get that sort of flavour sensation.
Yeah. And actually, those drinks actually complicate this story a little bit because, there were non-alcoholic spirits around quite early. So there's a non-alcoholic orange aperitivo from Italy called Crodino that was created in, I think, 1965. Mm. And the orange bitterness makes it a real substitute for something like Aperol. I used to actually drink a fair bit of it.
Okay, so do you still drink it? Is it still in your drinks cabinet?
No. And I'll tell you why. It's for the same reason I don't touch most of the spirits analogues, which is that they're often packed with sugar or some alternative like maple syrup or whatever to try and add mouthfeel.
Yeah, right. And there are a whole lot of non-alcoholic drinks which aren't attempting to be analogues, aren't there? But drinks kind of now in their own right. Mm. So they're sort of proxies. There's also another example in the UK, Bativo. So that's based on a type of another one of these amazing ancient herbal remedy books, I'm assuming, called Oxymel, which is being a blend of honey and vinegar.
Yeah, and I think some of the most interesting ones are actually the sparkling teas because you get the tannin doing a lot of work.
Yeah, and you know, that's of all the sort of non-alc categories, that's one that's growing. That's a really hot category at the moment, really growing fast, albeit, big caveat, from a very small base, but it is. But Felicity, we've done a lot of talking. We must try and sum this up.
Okay, so different non-alcoholic drinks emerged at different times, but often for the same reasons. There you go. I've summed it up.
Oh, yeah, well done. Always the editor.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is to offer an adult alternative to alcohol, which has some of the same cues and flavour profiles, so a serious drink that can be used on adult occasions.
That's right. So first of all, we had carbonated drinks that did the job, but they got infantilised because of a series of historical events.
Yeah, and particularly the emergence of ice cream, as it turns out.
That's right. But then the need came round again and somebody will always come up with a new type of liquid and the category, you know, becomes commercially serious again, which should be the end of the story.
Yes, and this is surprising because these drinks attract antagonism, but not just from the alcohol industry, which you think would see them as a threat.
That's right. In fact, the alcohol industry loves them because it means they can sell more drinks to a more varied audience in more types of places. But you know who doesn't love them is the public health lobby.
Yeah, so for the most of history we've been talking about, we've covered non-alcoholic drinks were a solution to alcohol, effectively, but there were genuine alternatives and the temperance people approved.
Yes, that's right. But now a growing number of public health academics, particularly in the UK and Australia, claim that the non-alc versions are dangerous because they're acting as gateway drugs. So what they're claiming is because you can advertise them in places where young people congregate, where it would be illegal to advertise the alcohol version, this is the industry's backdoor attempt to hook kids.
Yeah, exactly. And so before we assess whether this argument is well-founded, can we just take a really quick look at the market and the data? Because I think the context is really important here. So again, back to our friends at IWSR, data shows that there's a real embrace for no and low, as we were talking about, but it's not quite the gold rush that people claim. Again, we mentioned that previously. But most of the headline numbers, and this is really important, are for no and low, not just alcohol-free.
Oh, okay. So that really makes a big difference.
Yeah, it does, exactly, because most of the data is reporting both. And combined, the category, yes, it's been growing, but it's around 6 to 8% a year globally since 2019.
And, of course, that's off quite a low base. So although it looks explosive, it's not necessarily.
No, exactly, in terms of total volume, exactly. So, and it's also really uneven. So we were talking earlier that beer is doing most of the heavy lifting in the no alcohol. It's by far the biggest and most established category, as we've already said.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of sexiness happening, but it's happening small, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's in the no alcohol spirits that we were just talking about. So the fastest growth CAGR year on year, but off a tiny, tiny base. So lots of noise. Compound annual growth rate. Compound annual growth rate, Felicity. Okay. So lots of noise, but yet not lots of volume. And looking ahead, IWSR is still forecasting kind of roughly mid single digit growth in the no and low alcohol. So it's not a fad, but it's not replacing alcohol wholesale anytime soon.
Okay. So do you have any data on who's actually drinking the non-alc alternatives?
Yeah, so the biggest markets are globally, there's a number, but I would say that let's think about US, Brazil and UK with a CAGR, compound annual growth rate, of around 30%.
What's the category entry point, Lily?
I'll manage to get it in before the end of the episode. Yeah, even though I'm going to have to think about it now because we're nearly at the end of the episode. So UK CAGR, compound annual growth rate, 2019 to 2024, for no and low, around 30%. So these are, in some markets, we are seeing significant growth, but still, even with those compound annual growth rates, it's still relatively small.
Yeah. Okay, but let's steel man this. The argument they're making is that teenagers see the branding for Heineken Zero and it embeds the Heineken brand in their heads, so they're more likely to try the alcoholic version.
Yeah, and there's a problem with that because IWSR also reports that nearly half of consumers are switching from alcohol. So when they're looking for a non-alcoholic alternative, they're not actually going to the no or low, you know, the Me Too products, but they're actually primarily switching to, we've mentioned this but in a previous episode, water, tea or coffee. So we can also see in the data that much of the growth in the category, therefore, isn't coming from people reducing their alcohol intake. It's coming from adults kind of upgrading their non-alcohol occasions. And these products are in the main competing, you know, back with the likes of Coca-Cola.
Yeah, so pretty much doing what the Victorian soda fountain was doing.
Yeah, exactly. And the category is not primarily a sort of sobriety product, therefore. It's an adult beverage with sort of adult margins competing for occasions that previously had no zero alcohol adult or beverage alternative, which makes the a long way of saying, and I do witter on, which makes the gateway argument just not sort of empirically weak, but potentially strategically confused.
Yeah, I want to really double down on this because I want to make sure that we're not, sliding past a real argument. So the main argument that they're making is because you can put non-alcoholic advertising anywhere, you can shove alcohol brands in the face of kids in a way that would otherwise be illegal, right? So Heineken Zero can sponsor a school sports team in a way that they could never do with their alcohol brand.
Yeah.
So that's actually pretty plausible, right? So this is sometimes called alibi marketing, that you're not really marketing the non-alcoholic brand, but you're using it to make people think about the alcoholic brand. And that's the claim that by marketing it zero, you're actually making people think about the alcoholic one.
Yeah, and we should absolutely take that seriously because that's a properly serious argument in terms of mental availability. Got that one in there. Mental availability.
You're so clever, Luli.
Distinctive brand assets. Got that one in there. If you think about both Heineken and Guinness, the 0.0 versus the full regular strength versions, you know, from a distinctive brand asset point of view and from a mental availability point of view, effectively they're the same master brand, so absolutely that will be impacting in terms of, you know, kind of reaching younger consumers. But I'm imagining that a Heineken executive and investor briefing would deny that argument that you're building up that sort of master brand mental availability and awareness. But as part of the commercial logic, I guess the question is whether building brand equity for Heineken constitutes measurable harm to young people. And I guess that's the point we don't know yet because this is still a relatively new category.
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to what Bill Schufelt said about he liked the fact that Heineken and Guinness had it because it made the entire category into a real category that people would think about, you know, by it actually normalizes non-alcoholic beer. But I should say, you know, and the other thing is, although it's not classified as alcohol, in reality, most retailers treat it like it is and refuse to sell it to under 18s anyway.
Yeah, exactly, which tells you everything, doesn't it, about how confused this 0.0 beer, being the primary one category, still is.
Yeah, so there was a 2023 study in BMC Public Health that found that alcohol-free beer brands with strong visual ties to the master brand increased positive attitudes towards drinking in adolescent test groups. Now, that sounds really damning, but the issue that I have with that is I think it's actually meaningless. All right, so the reason that gateway drugs are so harmful is they might encourage you to try something like heroin or cocaine that you would otherwise never have touched. But the vast majority of people are going to try alcohol. So then the question is, does awareness of non-alcoholic brands cause kids to drink earlier or experiment in ways that they otherwise wouldn't have done?
That's such a key question, isn't it? Which is, and I would really want to see stronger evidence on this. So switching hats to our alcohol and health correspondent, Felicity, have you got some evidence on this?
Well, the evidence is unbelievably weak.
So
if these drinks were truly acting as gateways and prompting kids to drink more or drink earlier, I think you'd see it in the data, and you just don't. I mean, internationally, what you're seeing right now is a drop-off in young kids drinking.
Yeah, is that all markets or a specific market?
Well, no, I mean, no, and thank you for pulling me up on that. So in the UK in particular, you're seeing, underage consumption really dropping. In Ireland, binge drinking is surging among young people after having reversed for many years. But it would be very hard to make the argument that that's because of, you know, Heineken jerseys at school.
Yeah, exactly. So is there any evidence that non-alcoholic drinks are driving that? In Ireland,
for example. There's absolutely none that I know of. And we should say that, you know, the evidence really is that the more that non-alcoholic drinks become part of everyday life, the more likely they are to be chosen in circumstances where alcohol would normally be the default. Right. So because there's an increasing number of alcohol drinks adult drinks like proxies, which come in a wine-shaped bottle, but they're not pretending to be analogues for alcohol.
Yeah, and that raises the question about exactly where non-alcoholic drinks should be shelved, doesn't it? We were talking about the age restrictions and earlier. So in the alcohol aisles, is it, you know, next to the beer or is it in the soft drink section?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is I think most people who make non-alcoholic substitutes want it in the alcohol section away from kids because it gives them sort of legitimacy for alcohol occasions. But certainly in Germany, where I live, where the category is most mature, alcohol-free beer is shelved alongside its alcoholic equivalent. And there's no serious public health movement to change that.
Yeah, it's similar to what I see, for example, in the UK, although there is some inconsistency. But shelving by brand, some are by alcohol content and some are in other parts of the store because, of course, you can put it anywhere in the store if it's zero alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. And in markets like Norway and Sweden, where alcohol regulation is alcohol retail is very tightly controlled through state monopoly systems, these questions about where they should sit, you know, they have really big commercial and regulatory consequences.
Yeah, absolutely, because placement where you're physically placed in a, you know, in a system Belaget or a Vin Monopolet really determines whether a product can reach its sort of natural audience at all or not.
Yeah, and so what I find really curious about this sort of increasing tempo of outrage by the public health lobby against these non-alcoholic products is it's a complete reversal from where it all started. So the temperance movement of the 19th century said that alcohol poses a demonstrable risk of harm and therefore we should restrict it. And they welcomed alternatives.
Yeah, and then we've got today the public health lobby is saying that alternatives that look like alcohol pose a hypothetical risk of harm, therefore we need to restrict those too.
Yeah, and I really think it's a case of shooting yourself in the foot. So the master brands, the Heinekens and the Guinness, give people the confidence to try the non-alcoholic version. And the more they like it, the more likely they are to either choose it instead of alcohol or to switch now and then. So clamping down on the marketing of non-alcohol might actually be counterproductive, I think. Anyway, that's me ranting. Yeah. What are your thoughts about where the category is going, Lily?
So I predict that we'll continue to see the growth in particularly in non-alcoholic beer. But again, big data caveat here. Let's just put some scale on this, Felicity, because Guinness 00 is still only about 3% of total Guinness sales globally.
Oh, I didn't realise it was that low because, it comes across as this big success.
Yeah, well, it is because they sell a lot of beer, but it's still relatively low. And it does vary considerably by market. So in the UK, it's kind of closer to sort of high single digits as a percentage of the overall Guinness sold. And in retail, you know, gets bigger and bigger. But globally, it's still relatively small.
Yeah, and I want to go back to ranting about this because question of whether beer companies are using their zero, you know, products as a way to drive people to their alcoholic versions. I've had contact over the years with beer companies, and my belief, having done that, is that these big companies care about profit, not about craft. I honestly don't think they care if you drink their alcoholic or non-alcoholic versions. They just want your money.
Exactly.
They would sell fermented broccoli juice if it would make them money.
Please no. Well, then maybe that's our new line for listing. Anyway, in any case, what we're seeing is that the category is now large enough to attract regulatory scrutiny. Gosh, that's hard to say. Which I guess therefore sort of indicates it's a sort of sign of a maturing category because people are bothering about it now.
Yeah, and it also means the category is at a fork in the road, especially in the UK market. So in one future, brand extensions like Heineken Zero are allowed to advertise freely, which positions them as part of the mainstream.
Yeah, but on the other hand, tighter and tighter on the restrictions could mean that the products that thrive are those that are built have built independent identities from the start. So I'm thinking Athletic Brewing, for example, there.
Well, I guess in that scenario, Athletic Brewing would be better positioned than Heineken, and also I guess Seedlip already sits outside that brand extension frame entirely.
Yeah.
And then you get Giessen in New Zealand, which has built its non-alcoholic range of Sauvignon Blanc wines as a distinct product line. So I guess it will be okay. So this is really a question about which business model wins. And nobody can answer this because the regulatory picture is so unresolved.
And do you know what the irony of all of this is? That IWSR data shows that many people, as I said earlier, are simply just switching to water, tea and coffee.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so what are your thoughts about the future of non-alc wine, Luli?
So I remain sceptical about no non-alcohol wine. I really do. Not because the industry hasn't tried, but because, as we were talking about earlier, the product really has a structural problem. And as we mentioned, you take the alcohol out of wine and you're not just taking out the ethanol, you're taking out what most of us love wine for, which is the body, the aroma, the texture, all the stuff that's doing the heavy lifting. And you've also got an occasion mismatch. So wine is built around meals, often rituals, slowing down, and no alcohol wine kind of doesn't really deliver the same playoff. So I got there, Felicity. So you end up with a category entry point problem.
God. Thank you, Lily. Thank you.
Oh, it doesn't fit neatly into the category occasions and entry points where people naturally reach for wine.
I was wondering how long it would take you, and you've done it. I'm proud of you, Lily.
I got there, yes. I've shown remarkable restraint up to now.
I think that sabbatical is doing you so much good.
Well, as we both know, Felicity, getting back on track, growth starts with being easy to think of in the moment. And right now, no alcohol wine just isn't winning those moments, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've tasted my way through so many of them, and at their very best, they taste like cold tea. But how do your clients react when you tell them this?
Not very happily, but I keep telling them that. So, and I will continue to do so. But what's our conclusion, Felicity? Or have we got one?
No, I think we do. I think what we've discovered is that non-alcoholic is a growing category, but it's not as big as people think. And that the regulatory scrutiny that's coming down on it might be counterproductive. But what do you think, Lily? Is it going to go in the way of Coke? Are we going to see Seedlip for kids?
No, I think the non-alcohol alternatives are either going to be kind of off-limit to kids. I think they're, well, partly because they're expensive, aren't they? And they just wouldn't be of interest to that age group. But I also think we'll eventually see a lot of drinks that stop trying to pretend to be versions of alcohol and start just being interesting drinks in and of their own rights.
So no Seedlip fountains in our future.
I'm quite confident about that. But I think we've answered another question, Felicity. And don't forget, if you've got something you'd like Felicity and I to ramble and rant about, please drop us an email at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
Which actually means emailing Luli because she's the one that clears the inbox, even when she's in Central America.
I do, and thank you, Felicity.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.